It is 8:08, 64 degrees in the Twin Cities. Time now for one of my favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, who just got off a plane from Eastern Europe, if it's still called that, from Lithuania. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I got off the plane at 5 o'clock today, so I am freshly back.
Wow. Okay, well, listen, as always, and you travel, you know, often and sort of all over the place, although last time your trip was kind of cut short because of the government shutdown, wasn't it?
Correct.
Or one of your more recent trips.
Yeah, it was in January. January, I went to Slovenia. I was also supposed to go to Belarus. That one got cut short because of the government shutdown. And then in March, I was in Ukraine. So I've had the Eastern European World Tour this year so far.
Okay. And so tell us about where you were this time and what you were doing.
Okay. I was in Lithuania. Lithuania is one of the Baltic countries. It's kind of snuggled between east of Poland, west of Russia, and if I were to tell people, south of Latvia, that's where it is, right on the Baltic Sea. And I teach at a school called Mykolas Romeris Law School, which is in Vilnius, which is the capital. It's part of an exchange program between my school and a lot of other schools. So they bring in faculty to teach for like a week or so, mm-hmm. kind of like mini classes. So I was doing that. And also, as some of the listeners know, when I do these kind of things, I also generally give a program for the U.S. Embassy. So I spoke to a bunch of students over at the embassy on Monday. So it was a pretty busy week. And in case you're wondering, I think the interest in Europe in our 2020 presidential race maybe is almost as high as it is in the United States.
Really? Well, that's I'm always so interested to hear, you know, the perspectives and what people are saying, what people are asking you. But they're already focusing on the 2020 race.
Yes. And specifically what they're concerned about. Again, for people who don't know, Lithuania was independent after World War I till World War II. They were absorbed by the Soviet Union, and then they got their independence when the Soviet Union broke up. In fact, Lithuania was the first country to declare its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. Russia, for them, remains a constant concern and threat. And so I remember the first time I went to Lithuania in 2008, and it was during the presidential election between Barack Obama and John McCain. And the big concern then was they were like, well, is Barack Obama going to be there to defend us through NATO if Russia invades? And I said, well, yeah, and it was true. I mean, Obama was supportive of NATO. But the concern this time is given the comments that Trump has made about NATO and about what appears to be his relationship, you know, with Russia, which we're all still trying to figure out what it is.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, they're worried. They're worried about the fact that if the Russians were to take any type of aggressive military action against them, would the United States be willing to honor its NATO commitment? And that's the main concern, I think, that they have.
Really? And so they're obviously following that. And obviously the Mueller report, depending on which way you read the Mueller report, you know, didn't say that there was any direct collusion right. with the president, but certainly there was an awful lot of contact, and certainly the president's statements that have been very favorable to Mr. Putin.
Exactly.
It sounds like they're raising concerns over there.
Yes, in fact, I did two interviews also, one for a newspaper and one for, well, I think radio, and both of them were concerned about wanting to know more about the Mueller report, and they said they found the Mueller report confusing. Could you explain it? And I said, well, we found the Mueller report confusing in the United States too, and trying to work through what the report actually said. So it's interesting. Now, I should also mention the fact that Lithuania considers the United States to be a very, very good friend. Right after World War I, we were one of the first countries in the world that recognized their independence. And then during the Soviet era, we never formally recognized the Soviet Union's occupation and always considered Lithuania, along with the other Baltic countries, to be independent. So the relationship generally is pretty good, and they generally like people from the United States.
So they're basically trying to figure out what Donald Trump is really all about, which is just like the rest of us.
Exactly. So, okay. so they have the same perplexity that we do in terms of trying to, again, figure out who he is, what he supports. They want to know, of course, also, is he going to get reelected? So that's what I'm saying is that I could have moved you, Esme, to Lithuania, put you in and one of the television stations there, you know, and I don't know, LCCO, Lithuanian, whatever, like that, you know. And you would have been asking practically the same questions there as you would be asking here.
Well, and you know, in one of our earlier segments tonight, we talked with a financial analyst about the trade wars with China and the uncertainties it's created in the U.S. and even world markets. And, you know, one of the things that he was talking about is the unpredictability. And yes. No matter where you are, whether you support the president or you don't support the president or you're uncertain, I think most people fall into the either two camps, they support them or they doesn't. You know, you have to agree that he is unpredictable. And I think that's created a lot of people wondering at all levels, whether it's on China policy, foreign policy, right. What's going to happen in the next, is it just less than 18 months before the next election?
No, you're absolutely right. Now, the other thing which I noticed this time, too, and this is one of their concerns also, is in their financial district, it must have been a 40-story tall building for Huawei, the Chinese company,
and Huawei.
They were again one of the reporters, you know, who was kind of doing sort of business issues too, was asking us about the actions that Google was taking, that the Trump administration is taking with China, because I mean this is a major company in Lithuania, and I'm gonna go on a guess here and say 40% of the people who have cell phones, 40% of them are that brand.
Wow!
So this is a major employer over there, and so they're of course concerned in terms of how will the actions of both Google and the Trump administration impact a business that has a pretty big footprint in Lithuania.
Wow. Okay. All right. Listen, we do have to take a quick break. One of the things I want to ask you about is the tussle over testimony with William Barr, Mr. Mueller, a lot going on there. There are also a lot of questions that I want to ask you about some of these abortion laws that have been passed recently in other states, all kinds of things going on. So keep it here, folks. More with David Schultz after this on News Talk 830. It is 8:17. Esme Murphy, along with a man who should be very jet lagged. It's an 8-hour time difference between here and Lithuania. But I was saying in the break, we were chatting just briefly, you sound very refreshed.
Yes. A shower and a walk on a beautiful day like today did it.
Yes. And actually, this is one of the nicer days that's happened in the last God knows how long. But
My wife was telling me that actually where I was in Lithuania, it was uncharacteristically nice. Usually this time of year, it's kind of, let's say, 50s and 60s and raining.
That's what we've had.
Yeah, it was mostly in the 70s and sunny. It was gorgeous.
Wow. Okay. Well, I wish we could borrow some of that. Let me ask you, a lot going on about subpoenas and a new push, especially amongst progressives, for impeaching Donald Trump. Nancy Pelosi saying, no, it's not time, but a major war between Nancy Pelosi and the president. It is interesting, I think, that Nancy Pelosi, this is maybe a little bit of a side note here, say Nancy Pelosi seems to be somebody who can really get under the president's skin. What do you think is going to end up happening there? It does look like Democrats are holding off, at least the leadership is holding off, with a push for impeachment.
Yeah, I think they're holding off for a couple of reasons. One, I think they're operating under the assumption that movements towards impeachment might do more to mobilize the Republican base, that is Trump base, than necessarily the Democrats. And they're looking specifically at what happened when the Republicans tried to impeach Bill Clinton back in the 90s. It kind of backfired. Plus, I think on top of that, I think Pelosi's looking at it saying, listen, even if we impeach him, it's going to go down as a straight party line vote in the House. It's going to go down as a straight party line vote in the Senate. We're going to lose. And at least one point I've heard.
So it could win in the House, but it would lose in the Senate.
Correct. And you need a 2/3 vote in the Senate. And I've heard at least a couple of people argue and say that if the president were to be impeached and then acquitted in the Senate, he would use that as vindication, and I don't think the Democrats want to vindicate. But I think the other strategy that's going on at this point is that they're going to keep chipping away with subpoenas chipping away with perhaps contempts of Congress, and largely they're going to get most of the information that they want. They're going to eventually get the tax returns. They're going to get all that stuff.
Do you think that they will get? Because I know New York State passed a law that would allow the state returns, and normally your state returns have your whole income on it. So, you know, you can glean an awful lot from the state returns. Do you think that they will eventually get that?
Yeah, they're going to get them. They're going to get them from New York. They're eventually going to get them from Donald Trump's accountant, because there's going to be no way at the end of the day they're going to be able to suppress them. And possibly they will also get them through the Department of Treasury, through the IRS. But they're going to get them. And I think what they're hoping is that by getting those tax records, by doing the constant pressure that they're putting on the Trump administration, either perhaps they will eventually get enough information that convinces the American public to go ahead with an impeachment, that it leads to a significant mobilization of not just the Democrats, but also the swing voters who come out and vote against him in 2020. I think also, I'm just thinking about here on the timing issue here, is that if they take several months, you know, to fight this out, get the tax records, continue doing the hearings, this would then put the impeachment probably right in the middle of the 2020 presidential race, which potentially could be more damaging. So I think it's a cat and mouse game that, again, legally, the law is on the side of Congress.
Although, you know, I think that there are a lot of people, you know, for people going about their daily lives, you know, their take on the Mueller report as well. There was nothing there that was a crime.
Right.
It's what's done is done. It's over, which is what Republicans are saying. Isn't there something to that, or are Democrats being effective in kind of, as the president accuses them, of dragging it out?
Well, I think the Mueller report reaches certain conclusions that I don't think
it's certainly not flattering, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, one, you know, since I teach government ethics classes, I would say that even if he did nothing legally wrong, ethically, there's a whole bunch of problems there in terms of the president's behavior that one can raise a lot of questions on. But for the Democrats, I think they still believe they can make some political capital out of it. I think they still think there are some issues there. I think they also believe that there are issues that the Mueller report never really covered in terms of potentially tax fraud issues that there seems to be some allegations of. I think they're looking at the Russian connection in a different way in terms of how Trump may be connected with Russia through entities such as Deutsche Bank. So I think they're approaching it different ways. Whether this is going to resonate with the American public, I don't know. But what I think it's being effective at doing is preventing Donald Trump from being able to move his agenda. And I think that's partly what the Democrats are trying to do.
Interesting, because there's so much focus on this.
Yeah.
I do think it'll be interesting to see the tax returns. The New York Times did have a story, now it's been a few weeks, about a period in the late 1980s and early 1990s where he was in excess of $1 billion in debt. I thought that was interesting, but that was actually really out there. I mean, maybe it's because I've always read New York newspapers because, you know, as a child, I grew up there. That was very much out in the early 90s that Donald Trump was about to go under. And then he was able to kind of pick up the pieces. It would be fascinating to see what came after that.
Right.
And if it jives with what he's saying.
Right.
And he says, hey, listen, I used every tax loophole legally. I mean, all of that would be just really interesting to see.
It would be. I think the other thing that Donald Trump has to worry about here, too, is that there seems to be, and again, these are all allegation stages right now, allegations that, depending on whether it was for tax purposes or borrowing money, he was changing his claims regarding what his income was, you know, inflating or decreasing it. And the reason why I mention that is that given a lot of the business that he did, what could be uncovered here could be the basis for some civil lawsuits that could be brought against the President of the United States, maybe perhaps by creditors, maybe by Deutsche Bank. I don't know. I'm just sort of throwing this out here. And I mention that because the Supreme Court clearly ruled back in Clinton versus Jones, back when Bill Clinton was president, that presidents are not immune from civil lawsuits while they're president of the United States. And so I could see a possibility here also where some of this material comes out, Congress doesn't act, but it empowers some private parties to be able to bring some cases. And so view what's going on now. Again, if I'm overusing the term cat and mouse, I think this is exactly what's going on with Pelosi and Trump, is a cat and mouse game where she's doing a pretty effective job of what? Keeping him from being able to do anything except what? Be preoccupied almost on a full-time basis with responding to requests, subpoenas, and investigations taking place in Congress.
Let me ask you, I know that the president gave William Barr, the attorney general, sort of unprecedented powers to investigate the investigation of the Russia probe. And again, even for somebody like me, this all sort of glazes over. How big a deal is that? Because there's been a lot of controversy about that.
That is pretty significant at this point, because the reason why you brought in a special prosecutor or special investigator is because of the independence that that person would have from any political interference with the president or the Justice Department. To now have this investigation reviewed by the Attorney General really makes it look like what? That it's really not an independent investigation, that there is a lot more politics going on. And I think this actually hurts Donald Trump, because if he just sort of walked away from it right now and said, Mueller report vindicates me, walks away, this is what you were saying a few minutes ago here, he looks stronger. The more now he says, we're going to dig into this, we're going to see if there is any type of
It does keep it going.
It does keep it going.
And that's his initiative. It keeps it going. That's an interesting way of looking at it.
And if he and what if, let's say, Barr concludes and says this investigation was political, that is by Mueller, then what it does, it basically renders any of the conclusions that Mueller raised to be not, invalid, and therefore you're back to square one with the question of, all right, so it wasn't a fair investigation. And what would a fair investigation tell us about Trump's involvement with the Russians? And so this is a dangerous move for him to go.
And you're saying it could actually backfire.
I do.
Wow, that's interesting. That's very interesting. All right, well, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to do some weather. When we come back, I want to, ask you some questions about some of these abortion rulings, whether you think it'll go to the Supreme Court. And they also want to talk about the legislative session, which wrapped up this morning, very early this morning. So keep it here, folks. More with David Schultz, just back from Lithuania, on News Talk 830. It's 8:33 in the Twin Cities, chatting with Professor David Schultz, who is literally just back from Lithuania tonight, and he is kind enough to join us here on News Talk 830 WCCO. Want to ask you about your thoughts about these new abortion restriction laws that are being passed in a number of states. Since the beginning of the year, 8 states have passed laws restricting abortion rights in those states. The one that's gotten the most attention is a virtual ban of all abortions in the state of Alabama. What are your thoughts about what's going on there, and do you think this is going to end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court?
First off, let me explain what the current state of the law is that many people have heard of the case of Roe versus Wade, 1973, yes, which said that essentially women have a right to be able to terminate a pregnancy under some situations. That's the basic law. But in a later case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, I think it was, 1991, the court said that in evaluating regulations on abortion, the question is, do those regulations place an undue burden upon a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy? But the reason why I'm getting at this is that if you understand the framework here, that the law says that women do still have a right to terminate a pregnancy, and states can impose some regulations so long as it's not an undue burden. That gives us that legal framework. Okay. Having said that, what we're seeing here is several states going at a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade, in many cases eliminating either an ability of a woman to terminate a pregnancy or placing such significant restrictions on it that it raises the question, you know, is this an undue burden? And so what I think these states are doing is trying to set up a challenge. They're looking at the current Supreme Court and thinking that this may be their best shot ever in terms of a conservative court that may be willing to overturn Roe versus Wade or find, if they don't actually overturn Roe versus Wade, that these regulations don't place an undue burden and therefore uphold pretty significant restrictions. So I think this is the strategy at this point to try to get a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Having said that, first, I think given the election results in 2018, I think these are the kind of restrictions that are going to heavily mobilize women across the United States in ways that we haven't seen mobilized on the abortion issue, because I think many women always sort of took it for granted that the courts were going to be there. So I think, again, this is another issue that it may be overplaying by some conservatives. But second, I am not persuaded that the Supreme Court takes these cases. I think they're
really okay, and explain how that works, because I think that's an important thing. They only take a tiny percentage of the cases that are appealed to them, right?
Correct. There's approximately 3,500 or so cases a year in which plaintiffs ask the Supreme Court to hear a case on appeal from a lower court or from a state Supreme Court. They only accept about 80 cases per year, so it's an incredibly small percentage that they actually take. You know, what's 80 out of 4,000? We're looking at, you know, just maybe a percent or so in terms of the number of cases that they take. So the odds are generally against you. Second, I think this is a court, especially with John Roberts, who I think is very, very worried about whether the Supreme Court is looking politicized. I think he's going to look for ways to not take these cases.
Could the court theoretically say this is settled law?
They decided
this in 1973?
Yeah, what I'm thinking is likely to happen is that right now these laws across the country that are being passed, Alabama and so forth, they clearly violate Roe versus Wade. And I'll go out on a limb and say, as a law professor, they do place an undue burden upon a woman's ability to be able to terminate a pregnancy. The lower courts are bound by current Supreme Court opinion. They will have to strike these laws down as unconstitutional.
Because of that Supreme Court ruling.
Correct. So that what I think Alabama and other states are hoping is that, yeah, they know these cases are going to be struck down at the lower court level, hoping that they eventually get appealed up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court then takes it, and their hope is that by a 5-4 opinion, the Supreme Court upholds the lower court restrictions. I am, again, not convinced that the Supreme Court will take these cases, and they'll try to find ways of avoiding them. I certainly don't think they're going to overrule Roe. I've argued, and other people have argued, that there are ways of narrowing Roe if you're opposed to abortion without actually overturning Roe. So I think it's going to be a little bit more complex than many of these individuals think who are passing these laws. But I think especially the political backlash, I think, is pretty significant. And two, no legal guarantee that they're going to get what they want out of this.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you talked about the political backlash, because on Tuesday of this past week, I actually covered the rally at the Capitol, and that was against these laws in other states. And it was pretty hastily organized. It was organized to coincide with rallies in 300 cities across the country. And I think there were rallies also in Duluth and Grand Rapids. And I actually went my first stop was I called a state representative, Tim Miller, from Prinzburg,
right.
Who is he has proposed laws very similar to the Alabama ban, which is a virtual ban. He's proposed very similar laws in the Minnesota legislature. And I got him. He was driving back to Prinzburg after what it appeared just before the special session.
Right.
But he said he's going to keep trying. His proposals didn't get very far in the Minnesota legislature, but he proposed something very similar to the Alabama ban. So I got him. Then I stopped by Planned Parenthood and talked to the president of Planned Parenthood, Sarah Stace, and they were not sure how many people were going to turn out at this rally. And then I went to the rally, and the rally was packed. I mean, I there was no official crowd estimate, but it wasn't hundreds. There were at least a couple of thousand people there on pretty short notice, and they were pretty passionate and revved up against these laws in Alabama and Missouri and some of these other states. And what the folks at Planned Parenthood say and what they believe is happening is that people are, in fact, just what you were saying, energized and angry about the laws in the other states and motivated to come out and actually vote.
Right.
And it was that, you know, when you go back to the 2016 election and you look back at who voted and who didn't vote, mm-hmm. is you found that there was a smaller percentage, fewer Democrats voted.
Right.
Than had voted in the elections for Barack Obama. People
Correct.
Were not excited about Hillary Clinton, even women.
Correct.
And I think that's what they're hoping to channel this into.
I think that's what's happening here, because the 2018 election results across the United States, including Minnesota, were really driven by women and especially by suburban women. And driven by what? You know, whether it's Donald Trump's comments, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, I mean, by a perception of an incredible, you know, or it could have been the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, by a clearly very hostile, at least in their perspective, of a hostile environment against women. And now these anti-abortion laws are continuing that. And I think this has the potential of doing something fascinating. If that for so many years you had anti-abortion activists highly motivated and showing up at the polls, I think now these decisions, or rather these laws across the states, are having the impact in terms of mobilizing the pro-choice women across the country. And if that's true, if that's accurate, if women turn out to vote in 2020 in the way they turned out to vote in 2018, this will not be good news right. for Donald Trump or for Republicans.
And as opposed to 2016,
correct.
When a lot didn't turn out. But that is exactly what the Planned Parenthood folks are actually sort of banging on, and they think it's happening. And
yeah.
of course, we won't know
right.
For a while. But it's interesting. So you think that there's a very good chance that these laws will actually end up getting struck down by lower courts,
correct.
And then getting appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. You think that there's a chance that the U.S. Supreme Court won't take it. If they do take it,
uh-huh.
and obviously this is an if, you've had, and I think this is something that people really don't think of when they vote for president. When you're voting for president, you're also voting for the person who can appoint a lifetime appointees mm-hmm. to the U.S. Supreme Court. And Donald Trump, in 2 very short years, got 2 chances.
That's right. That's right.
You know, already. And his first term isn't even up. He was able to appoint Neil Gorsuch and obviously Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
Brett Kavanaugh being an especially controversial appointee after those unbelievable hearings. It's possible he could appoint even more. I
That's
mean, some
right.
of these more liberal justices are very senior.
That's right.
And obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg suffering from cancer. She looks like she's doing really well, but she's in her 80s.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Now, let me throw one other dimension in here, too, is with these abortion decisions is that, and we saw this happen in Kansas recently, where the Kansas Supreme Court came back and ruled under its own state constitution that abortion laws were unconstitutional and that a right to a woman to terminate a pregnancy is protected under the state constitution. And the reason why that is important is that if a state Supreme Court rules under their own constitution that a woman's right, woman has a right to privacy or a right to terminate a pregnancy. The U.S. Supreme Court cannot overturn that. And that's exactly what happened in Minnesota back in the 90s, where the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a case, Women of Minnesota versus Gomez, and where the court ruled, Minnesota Supreme Court said that under the Minnesota state constitution, women do have a right to basically terminate their pregnancies under some situations. And so I mention this because look to see how perhaps the politics and the litigation of these abortion cases might produce some surprises at the state court levels in terms of how they rule also. I can't remember if I've ever told you that one of the classes that I teach in law school, I actually teach state constitutional law. And so there are strategies in terms of how you could use federal litigation or state litigation or state versus federal constitutions to do certain things. And that's what we saw in Kansas a few weeks ago in terms of them upholding, rather, I mean, sorry, striking down some of the state abortion laws, ruling they violated the state constitution.
If it did go to the Supreme Court, though, are you saying that it's not necessarily a slam dunk against abortion rights?
I don't think it is a slam dunk against it because...
Despite the two new conservative justices.
Yeah, because it's going to, because everybody's perceiving it's going to be 5-4. I think Roberts is very, very worried about the fact that this court is looking increasingly politicized. And we've already seen him in a few situations in the last couple of years flip and vote with the liberals out of that fear. So I'm not saying that the Supreme Court won't narrow reproductive rights, but I think it's highly unlikely they'll do a broad overturning of Roe versus Wade.
Interesting. All right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Professor David Schultz about the legislative session that ended no government shutdown. Yes, there was a special session, but it was a very brief one. More with David Schultz after this. You're listening to News Talk 830. It is 8:49 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy along with Professor David Schultz. And again, a big thank you to you for not crashing. You must be exhausted because right now it's, what, 4 in the morning or something like that?
It'll be close to 5 in the morning.
5 in the morning.
That's right. It's time to get up.
Time to get up. Okay.
I was going to say, you don't get much sleep on Saturday night either.
I don't. Yes, and I will be there bright and early at 6 a.m. And also 10:30 a.m. I want to ask you about the legislative session. We did play, there was a clip that's been used in a number of newscasts by Mark Frey of Kurt Dowd, the minority leader, the House minority leader, the former House Speaker, Republican, of course, saying nothing got done this legislative session. I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah. They did get the budget done. They did do some small increases for, like, let's say, like on education, a few things here. What they didn't get done is something that I think has been frustrating the legislature for years, some kind of more global plan in terms of let's say, you know, road bridges, highway reconstruction. I couldn't tell by looking at it. Did they actually pass a bonding bill or not?
Yes.
Okay, but I think it's a pretty small one if I compare.
Right, they didn't get his gas tax. They got all the funding bills done.
Right.
But they and they did keep that medical provider tax.
Although at not 2%, but I think 1.8%.
1.8%. So they got that. But
right.
I think they also did some other things. I think that the distracted driving bill is a big deal. I mean, I know it's not a money bill, but I mean that affects everybody in the state. I think it's a big deal.
That's a big deal. The marital rape law, I think, is significant also. But in terms of, if we look at like at the beginning of the legislative session, the Democrats had a list of what I think their top 10 bills they wanted to pass in the House. Either they didn't pass, or let's say shadows of them, you know, skeletons of them passed. So I don't think it's accurate to say that nothing got done, but what would be a more accurate description is to say that it was pretty ugly how it got done.
Right. But it was less ugly than it has been in past years.
yes, but right, you're right. Okay, you're right. Okay, couple interesting statistics here now. If we go back 20 years, you know, every 2 years, you know, in the odd year is when they have to do the budget. Okay, so that means in the last 20 years, there's been There's been 10 biennial sessions to do the budget. They've now had to go over time eight out of those 10 times. 8 out of 10 times where they had to go to special session. We've had during that time 2 partial government shutdowns, almost a third, and then in 2 other instances, we've had the governor and the legislature square off with issues that had to be resolved by the Supreme Court. Last year, I called this the new normal, and that's what it is now. The new normal is what? That we're going to go to overtime, you know, that things are not going to be very pretty. The part that I think was the not prettiest, that's not a good way to describe it, the least pretty thing about this session was how in the last couple of weeks, it was all done behind closed doors, and I think that's a concern.
Right. Right, and that was a criticism that was leveled by former Speaker Dowd, because he was shut out,
yep.
So he was not behind the closed doors. I think that there was a tremendous desire by the governor and the lieutenant governor to really not take this too much into overtime. Yes, or yes, it went to special session. He said, he said he was calling it overtime, but to not have a government shutdown.
Yes.
And I think that was very important. Another thing I think they did, which I do think is very important, and I will have Senator Karen Housley on our 10:30 show, there was a significant bill that really rewrites the oversight of assisted living. I mean, assisted living facilities weren't regulated or weren't at all in Minnesota, which is shocking.
Yes.
Nursing homes were, assisted living facilities were not, and I think that's a big deal. They did get that done. They did get an opioid bill, which they hadn't been able to do before. So they were able to get a number of things done. No, it's not pretty. I do think, though, that the way the Minnesota system is set up, with the entire Senate not being up for election in 2018, it was only the House that was up. So the Senate got to stay Republican because they weren't up. It's not clear if the Senate would have flipped, but we can, you know, that's a hypothetical there. It'll be interesting to see what happens again in 2020. And I think, and I would expect we're going to see Governor Tim Walz hit the road hard. Especially in those Senate districts where he actually carried them and there was a Republican incumbent senator. I bet we're going to see Tim Walz campaigning pretty hard in those districts.
I do, too. And I think we're going to see 2 different election cycles that are going to be important. 2020, the entire legislature is up. And then in 2022, it'll be the first elections after redistricting occurs. And keep in mind that when the Senate elections take place next year, they're not for 4 years, they're only for 2 years. So that what will happen 2022...
Minnesota's system is so complicated, isn't it?
It is incredibly complicated, which is why my classes are so much fun, because I have to make sense out of all these bizarre things we do in the state.
Does anybody else have a state senate that 1 year is...
No.
They're elected for 4 years, and the next year they're voted for 2 years?
Nope. We're the only one in the country that truncates the Senate 4-year terms to 2 years when it gets to, like, the census. So I mentioned...
Is that only on the census years?
Only on the census year, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
My head hurts.
Yeah. So what's going to happen in 2022?
I'm glad we have you around to
right, yeah.
It was keeping track
right,
of this.
Right. So all the legislature and at that point and the governor will be up in 2022. So the next 2 election cycles are going to be incredibly important. Then, of course, in 2020, we also have what? We also have the presidential election, and I'm assuming Tina Smith is going to want to run again for office. She's got to run again next year.
She's got to run again. So a lot going on, a lot to talk about for the years ahead.
Yes. We have full employment for the next few years.
Okay. Well, listen, Professor David Schultz, thank you so much for coming on. You get some rest. I'm glad you had a safe trip back from Lithuania, and I certainly appreciate your time, and as do all our listeners.
Thank you very much. Good night to everybody.
All right. Absolutely. Good night, David Schultz. Great guy for coming on after really a long trip. He's got to be absolutely exhausted. Well, listen, I just want to give a huge shout out to the producer of this show, Susan Blanche. She does a fabulous job. I want to thank Susan for getting a great group of guests together. Also want to thank Devin Marshall for keeping us on the air. Thank you, Devin.
Thank you.
And he's got a long day. And he's got to come back here and make sure that Sid Hartman and Dave Mona and that whole crew gets on the air, and that's really important.
Yeah, counting down the hours.
Counting down the hours. I bet you are, Devin.
Just see Sid's smiling face.
All right, folks. And again, I do want to invite you to tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Senator Karen Housley, who is the author of that new bill that will regulate assisted living facilities in the state of Minnesota, it will be a live guest. I'll also ask her about whether she'll run again against Tina Smith. We don't know. But really, this is a big bill. It's very important. It's bipartisan. And so many of us now have loved ones who are in assisted living. So tune in, folks. And thank you so much for tuning in tonight.